On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Not long ago, the headlines from urban America were all about dropping crime rates and dramatic reductions in homicides. But today, many cities are being hit again by a troubling escalation of gun violence. Mayors from Seattle to Milwaukee to New York are alarmed by what they say is a thriving trade of illegal guns flooding their cities. Local cops need help, but federal law prevents them from sharing information about where the guns are coming from. The gun lobby says go after the criminals, not the guns. And now the Republican-led House wants to make it even harder for cops to track down illegal weapons. Up next on Point, the political shootout over illegal guns. And joining me from Boston is Michael Blanding. He's a contributing editor to Boston Magazine and author of last month's feature story on the illegal gun trade in Boston Magazine. He also writes for other publications, including The Nation, Salon, and The Boston Globe. And Michael, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Listen, give us a sense of the growing concern, if you would, in many cities about illegal guns. Earlier this spring, we saw a so-called gun summit in New York organized by Mayor Bloomberg with a bunch of other big city mayors. What's going on? What are they concerned about? What's the problem?
Well, what mayors and police officers have seen around the country is just a dramatic rise in violent crime and in particularly homicides over the past year or so. You know, for years the trend was the other way, that violent crime was dropping, and even though some cities had seen homicide rates go up, like here in Boston, the trends were really the other way. And within the past year, there's just been a dramatic spike. Some cities, you know, seeing 15, 20, up to 40% rise in homicides. And one of the things that's different than the last time that rates were this high, which was about a decade ago, is just the accessibility of handguns. And police are seeing that there's just, you know, many more guns are being taken off the streets, and there's just a real willingness, and particularly among teenagers and younger teenagers, to use guns. So in cases where, you know, altercation may have ended in a fist fight or a knifing, In the past, that now more often than not they're ending in gunfire,
and this has a lot to do with the relative ease with which these young folks can get hold of guns. What do the mayors want? What would they like to see happen in terms of preventing these guns from coming into their cities?
Well, when the mayors came together in April, they were looking at it a couple of things, but primarily, they're looking to stiffen the federal laws. You know, right now, there are different laws in different states that make it easier to get handguns in states. In some states, so for folks in places like New York or Massachusetts or California that have really strict laws against handguns, there are gun traffickers that are going to neighboring states down south or another western states and trafficking guns into these states with these urban centers, and so they're looking to have more uniform federal laws that would make it equally difficult to obtain guns in any of these states.
Yeah, so Michael, tell us how, in other words, if you're in a city like New York, let's say, where there's relatively strict gun control laws, getting guns into that city is easy because folks can just leave the city and go into a state where laws aren't as strict. I mean, is it that simple? It's just a case of going to a nearby rural state or the South?
It really is. It's really a lot of supply and demand. And, you know, in New York, for instance, 82% of guns come from outside of the city. And what happens is you have these gun traffickers that go down I-95 South, they call it the Iron Pipeline, and they go to states like South Carolina or Georgia where it's relatively easy to get a handgun, or they go north to states like Vermont or New Hampshire and buy guns there. They can buy, you know, a number of guns at a drugstore or at a gun show, bring them into the city and make a nice profit.
Mm. Now, one of the challenges that I've heard facing law enforcement is the trick in tracing these illegal guns, and there is data that could help them trace it, which comes from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. But local police are limited as to how they can access that information and use it. Can you explain just a little bit how that works?
Yeah, it's actually really difficult to trace handguns, and it's sort of been made difficult by design, where it's not like something like a car, for instance, where you could just type the VIN number into a computer and get the history of that car. you actually have to send a request to the National Gun Tracing Center and wait for a response to come back, and it can take anywhere from weeks to months to come back. And when it does, all that you'll get with that is the last known point of sale for that gun. And, you know, we know from gun trafficking that oftentimes someone will buy a gun legally, you know, they'll use a straw purchaser, they'll use a fake ID, and they'll buy a gun somewhere, and then it will be sold and resold several times before it actually gets to the shooting. So the cards are really stacked against the police in tracking these weapons.
And now there are bills pending in Congress which would make that easier. What's going on there? What can you just describe briefly what the proposed legislation in Congress would do?
Yeah, there are three bills that are being proposed, and there's a range of things. One of them would make it more difficult for licenses to get revoked from gun dealers. Another one would make it possible to buy a handgun without having a state ID from the state where you're buying it. And then the third one, which I think is most disturbing for law enforcement, has to do with tracing. And it would make it it would sort of codify laws that have been sort of temporarily enacted that would make it illegal for the ATF to share tracing data with the public, with journalists, and with law enforcement outside of a specific investigation in a specific geographic area, which is a very, very limited range.
Now, what's the argument in favor of that law? Because on the face of it, to hear you describe it, it's sort of like, why would you want to keep that information private, especially out of the hands of cops who are trying to chase down illegal guns? What's the argument in favor of that?
Well, I think there's two arguments. One has to do with the argument for gun owners, and it really has to do with the culture of gun ownership, where the fear is that any gun control law is eventually going to end up on the slippery slope of taking people's guns away. And so in these states that, you know, don't have these problems with, you know, urban crime, they see, you know, anything that's going to lead to registration of gun or tracing guns is sort of taking, you know, one step closer to taking guns away. But I think the more compelling reason has to do with the gun industry. And, you know, number one, that these laws, by limiting gun sales, you're actually limiting the profits of gun manufacturers and gun dealers. And number two, there have been a number of attempts to actually sue gun manufacturers over the murders that have taken place in cities, in particular in New York. There's a lawsuit right now that's trying to hold gun manufacturers accountable. And one of the ammunition, so to speak, for this lawsuit is this gun tracing data. And so by keeping it out of the hands of law enforcement, you're also keeping it out of the courts. And I think that is probably more than anything the real impetus behind these laws.
Very interesting. Okay, Michael, thank you so much. You've put a lot of good ideas for discussion for the rest of the hour on the table. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. That's Michael Blanding, contributing editor to Boston Magazine. His May feature story, The Ways of the Gun, can be found in Boston Magazine. Let me bring in one of the people from the front lines in this issue is Byron Brown, joining us from Buffalo, New York. He's the mayor of Buffalo, New York, and he's one of the original 13 mayors in Mayor Bloomberg's summit of mayors dedicated to stopping the illegal gun trade. And Mayor Brown, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you, Mr. Brooks.
I'd love to get your take on the challenge that you're facing in your city when it comes to illegal guns.
Well, it's a tremendous challenge. Last year, 2005 alone, we saw over 686 illegal guns in the city of Buffalo that we were able to identify.
And so what does that mean in terms of what you're seeing on the streets and your concern about that?
Well, that means that there are a lot of illegal guns on the street. These illegal guns are too easy to obtain. They often get into the hands of young people who seem more and more willing to use them. And unfortunately, over the years, we've had far too many homicides in the city of Buffalo with young people involving the use of an illegal gun.
Hmm. So what's the answer? What would you like to see happen that isn't happening?
Well, you talked about with your last guest some of the legislation at the federal level that would make the illegal gun trafficking epidemic worse. I would certainly like to see those pieces of legislation defeated. We certainly don't want to have legislation at the federal level that would make it easier to get illegal guns in the hands of people, and we certainly don't want legislation that would make it harder to prosecute or take action against irresponsible gun dealers or traffickers.
Mm. And we were talking earlier with Michael Blanding of Boston Magazine about this one piece of legislation that would make it more difficult to share data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms about where these illegal weapons come from. You see that as a problem. I mean, you would like to see this data shared as widely as possible. Is that fair?
Absolutely. That bill, it's H.R. 5005. It would make it harder for the ATF to share data, including sharing data with municipalities. And we certainly think we need to have it be made easier to share data so that at the local level we can crack down on this epidemic of illegal guns being used in communities all across America. And unfortunately, at the federal government level, they are not showing the proper leadership. So it has to happen at the local level, and that's why I applaud Mayors Bloomberg and Menino for organizing the mayoral summit on illegal guns.
Okay, well, Mayor Brown, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and best of luck to you. Joining me now from Frederick, Maryland, is Joseph Vince. He's now retired. He was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, where he created the Gun Analysis Branch. He now teaches criminal justice at the Mount St. Mary's University and manages a consulting company, Crime Gun Solutions, LLC. He's also on the board of directors of the American Hunters and Shooters Association, a new organization that seeks to advocate for gun owners and also for sensible gun safety laws. And welcome to you, Joseph Vince.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
It's great to have you. Also want to introduce from Springfield, Virginia, Larry Pratt. He's executive director of the national organization Gun Owners of America and host of the radio show Live Fire. And Larry Pratt, welcome to you.
Hello. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you, and I appreciate you coming in today. I want to engage you both in sort of solutions and ideas about how to solve this problem that the mayors have sort of outlined for us. So let me start with you, Joseph Vince. I'm interested to hear your perspective as a former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. How do you see the problem as it exists today in American cities, concern over illegal guns?
Right. Well, one of the things that I also do is I'm a technical assistant for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And the one thing we try to get law enforcement to do is to use a myriad of prevention and enforcement techniques. Because what we've found over time is to be effective in reducing firearms-related violent crime, you have to have intervention, prevention, as well as enforcement. And keeping the guns out of the hands of criminals are what we're all after. Not worried about hunters or shooters or law-abiding citizens having firearms. It's keeping the guns out of the hands of criminals. If we can do that, we have found that no matter what other weapon a criminal uses, either the victim is not seriously injured or killed. So if we can do that, we have reduced violent crime. No one's ever heard of a drive-by shooting with a knife.
Mm. So what's the best approach to do that? And I guess one of the ways I wanted to keep this conversation a little bit fresh is I'm hearing a lot of concern about pending legislation in Congress that would make it difficult for local law enforcement to get hold of gun trace data and to really understand where these guns are coming from. How important is that?
It's very important because what you want to do in law enforcement is turn firearms information into firearms intelligence, useful information that you can use every day to solve crimes from homicide, armed robberies, et cetera, as well as prevent these things from occurring. If we can do that, we will be successful in reducing firearms-related violent crime. Simply putting criminals in jail isn't going to do the trick. We've seen that. We've seen places that have had tremendous startup programs like Exile, but they fade even though we've arrested criminals because we're not keeping this flow of guns back to the new criminal. Since Cain and Abel, we've had criminals. We're always going to have them. How do we make them less violent? Mm.
Larry Pratt, I want to bring you in, obviously, into this discussion. I know that you're going to talk this hour a lot about defending legitimate gun owners' rights and the importance of the Second Amendment. So chime in here. Does Joe Vince have it right that the problem here is to keep these guns out of criminals' hands?
I think the problem is that we're using the wrong terminology. We're talking about gun tracing when actually what we have already in the United States is a decentralized form of gun registration. We have dealer records that are maintained year upon year, and we do have some central data available in Washington, D.C. on gun owners as well. When the gun registry was used during the Beltway sniper episode, there were efforts to locate the shooter by using the registration of gun owners, and they got the sales of firearms to people that had purchased guns with the same caliber as was being used in the murders, and they went door to door trying to find some leads to where the shooters might be. Well, at the time, I told the media, you're not going to find it that way because gun registries don't solve crime. Anecdotally, you can find a few cases, but
why
overall,
not? Why
they
not,
don't.
Why not, Larry Pratt? Why couldn't they solve crime if they were more complete?
For the same reason that I have pointed out in the Beltway Sniper episode, they will find the gun when they find the bad guys. And that's exactly what happened. Unless the bad guy happens to leave his own registered gun at the scene of the crime, you're never going to trace him from that gun. And as a result, gun registry and gun traces are not a useful law enforcement tool.
But isn't one of the problems, Larry Pratt, that a lot of guns aren't registered? I mean, for instance, legitimate gun dealers have to do background checks. They sell a new gun. That gun is registered. But at gun shows all across the country, guns can change hands and be sold legally without being registered. And so that's one of the problems that law enforcement faces is they can't trace these guns, or it's very, very time-consuming to do so.
The untraceability of guns is not a problem in, say, Northern Virginia, which has twice the urban population of Washington, D.C., and yet Washington, D.C.'s murder rate is somewhere between 35 and 40 per 100,000 this year. Fairfax, Virginia's is under 1 per 100,000. So I don't think you can make any good connection between tracing and solving crimes. In Canada, they've had a handgun registry since 1934. And in the debate in the run-up to the recent election that was partly determined on the basis of the failure and the cost and the scandal of the gun registry, the issue was out on the table. Well, the registry has never been used once to solve a crime.
Joseph Vince, Larry Pratt says the untraceability of guns is not a problem. Is that do you buy that?
Well, first of all, up before the early 1990s, we used firearms tracing to really investigate a crime and a firearm. And really, it was extremely a useful tool and did solve a lot of crimes. Everything from murders rates, high-profile cases, down to what law enforcement looks at and investigates every day. However, we've got to get serious here, and as I teach my students in the university, is to be critical thinker. What is the evidence around you supports this? And what we have to do is take this information and turn it into intelligence that we can use. We have limited resources in law enforcement, and in order for us to be effective, we have to focus our resources. We do that with information and intelligence. And the fact of the matter is that when you start to look at this information, it gives you patterns of activity. You know, we should have learned a few years ago from the health, our health side, who went after the SARS epidemic. And we had an outbreak of SARS. We had to get rid of this before we had a pandemic in the world. And we said, okay, everybody that got infected with this, we'll treat you. We'll help you get better. But we went and found out where the source is and eradicated that. We have to do the same thing with firearms. It's not an idea of having more laws. It's not handcuffing law enforcement, which we're doing now, to do their jobs. Let us go and get the source as well as putting the bad guy in jail.
Let's take a call, 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join the conversation about the illegal gun trafficking and what can be done about it. Bella is calling from Hubbardston, Massachusetts. Hi, Bella.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for the call. What's on your mind?
I'm a gun owner. All of my guns are duly licensed and registered. I don't have any problem with that. I do feel that going to increased restriction is going in very much the wrong way for us as Americans.
Mm.
In England, they not only have they legislated all firearms, but they're now even talking about regulating knives, kitchen knives, pocket knives, things like that.
Well, why, Bella, tell me why you think increased gun control legislation
is
a mistake.
Sociology and the statistics suggest that it's exactly the opposite, that restricting lawful citizens' access to firearms actually means that they don't have access with them to protect themselves and are expected to depend in every instance entirely on the police for their own personal protection and defense and security.
Okay. Okay, Bella, well, thanks for putting that thought on the table. That's certainly an idea that we want to discuss. Joseph Vince, there you hear from Bella and from a rural part of Massachusetts saying gun control is going to take the guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens. That's essentially the argument that she's making there.
Again, I think the whole premise of our show today is allowing law enforcement to use information to solve crimes and mm-hmm. keep the hands out of criminals. We're not talking about restricting gun rights for law-abiding citizens at all. And I don't think anybody, neither Larry or I, are saying that. What we're saying is, let's get serious about this. Why would we allow or want people to sell firearms, to get a license, have a background check on them to make sure that they're good citizens, to make them keep meticulous records, support law enforcement, and be open for audits, and then we just allow everybody else to sell firearms, especially at gun shows, go around like the Frito Bandino and buy me, where there's no record checks on the individuals that purchase them. The buyer doesn't know who the seller is, and the seller doesn't know who the buyer is. Doesn't that open it up for criminals to get firearms? It doesn't make any sense. That's not being a critical thinker.
Yeah, Larry Pratt, let me sort of develop that idea and get you to respond to it. Some of the reporting that I've done, and we've heard this, Boston police say 60% of crime guns now come from out of state. New York police say 80% of their crime guns now come in from out of state. So doesn't that argue in favor of the kind of traceability that Joe Vince is talking about?
I think quite the contrary. I think it shows that gun control is failing because the problem, very generally, is not in the states that have less gun control, less restrictions on gun owners, have made it actually easier for people to get guns. Those are the states that the crimes they're not happening there. The guns, for some reason, seem to wait until they get to the states that are very restrictive, like Washington, D.C., New York, whatever.
But wait, I'm not sure I heard you correctly. You said that the existing gun control laws make it easier for people to get hold of guns. Is that what you did? I hear you wrong?
You didn't. You did hear me wrong. What I'm saying is that in the states where you have less control, less gun control, where it's easier for people to get guns, those are the states that typically have less violent crime, less of a murder rate. The guns don't become a problem in Virginia. They become a problem because of the people using them in Washington, D.C., or in New York, or in Boston. And I think that has to do with the fact that the criminals are emboldened by the restrictions that have applied not to them, but only to the folks who might use a gun to defend themselves.
And I disagree with that. Richmond, Virginia, that's a horrendous crime rate, a horrendous shooting rate. Look at Dallas and Houston, Texas, where everybody has a firearm. They carry it in their vehicles. They have the least amount of gun laws that there are, and they have the highest percentage of capital punishment. Yet their shooting rates are off the Richter scale.
Well, that's
just not true.
Those are not accurate data. Richmond used to have a higher murder rate, but after the enforcement of a uniform state law regarding getting concealed carry permits, its murder rate went down. And Dallas, Texas, by no means has the highest murder rate in the country. That's a distinction that's vied for every year between Detroit and Washington, D.C. The fact of the matter is the states that have no gun control to speak of other than federal law are Vermont and Alaska, and those are two of the very lowest of the murder rates of the country. People can carry there without any restriction whatsoever.
But Larry Pratt, I mean, Vermont and Alaska, they're very rural states. I mean, aren't we talking about problems that have to do with urban violence? So, of course, you're going to
No, because Fairfax County, Virginia is a very urban county, and for people that haven't seen it, I'd invite them to come here. It took me about I don't know, an hour to do a 15-minute trip this morning. The traffic is very, very urban. We have a very urban and densely populated county that's over twice the population of Washington, D.C., and yet we have a murder rate that's actually even lower by a little bit than Vermont's, because we are a place where people can get access to guns and carry them readily. Totally unlike Washington, D.C., where there is a virtual ban, and you certainly can't carry or use a gun in self-defense. So to argue that somehow the guns are coming from these, say, southern states and moving north and causing the problem overlooks the irrefutable fact that the guns are not a problem in those states of origin.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Wade, who's calling from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Hello, Wade.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for joining the conversation. What's on your mind?
Well, I hear your panelists, and I agree and disagree both. I'm from a very rural area. But in just watching the news today, the Golden Nugget Casino in Las Vegas had a young man open up fire on innocent people that were in there maybe enjoying a vacation trip or... How are we getting firearms into casinos and into places where people have disagreements and they're not fighting them with fists anymore? They're fighting them with weapons and shooting innocent people in the process.
Hmm. Wade, I just see from my producer's notes that I hope you don't mind me identifying you. You're a former Florida State Trooper. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, I'd love to, you know, get you. I mean, you pose this rhetorical question. I'd love you to answer it as a law enforcement officer on the front lines, or as a former law enforcement officer on the front lines. I mean, what's the answer here to that question? How are these guns showing up in places like Las Vegas casinos, and what has to happen?
Well, I just feel we're having a pandemic of what's called community weapons now, where they're being hid in the neighborhoods and criminals are given the opportunity to say to the other, you can find your weapon here at this time and it'll be readily available to use in a crime. And again, it makes it harder for law enforcement to do their job. We're out there trying to make traffic stops on what we believe are that might be fruitful in the event of if we conduct a search and find illegal weapons or contraband. But it's just really frustrating, as you point out, that our legislatures are making these laws that are making it harder for law enforcement officers who put their lives on the line every day to do their job.
Yeah. All right, Wade. Well, I appreciate your call.
Anthony, can I say something
please,
while Wade's
ahead.
On there?
This is Joe Vince.
I see also an issue of officer safety that we're ignoring, and it's huge. Every day in every city and rural areas of this country, police officers, troopers make vehicle stops. They have a need to know if people have ever been involved in a crime gun. The legislation that you see now is going to make it so that they can't get that information. That information is vital, and it doesn't matter if the person was involved in a crime gun in the state that they're in or two states over or across the country. The officers need to know that so they can enhance their officer safety.
And Larry Pratt, just before the break, I wanted to ask you about this bill pending in Congress, H.R. 5005, that would prevent ATF from releasing to the public crime gun trace data linking illegal guns to high-risk dealers and so forth. I think one could argue sort of generically that information is power. So why do you want to limit that the use of that information? I don't understand the argument against it at this point, I guess.
One of the arguments that was made just a minute ago was put forth by the former Florida trooper, or at least came out of the discussion with him, that somehow this would make officers somewhat safer in traffic stops if they had the information about the people they're stopping, whether they'd had a gun, whether they had this or that kind of a history. The fact of the matter is, if an officer were to rely on computer data of that sort and have his guard down, he could very well end up getting himself shot for having relied on that information, because the information isn't going to be complete, it's not going to be always accurate, And the fact of the matter is, it's not going to help the officer in identifying who might be a criminal behind a wheel any more than it did in the Beltway Sniper episode, or any more than it helped the Canadians find zero criminals from their gun registry for over 70 years. The fact of the matter is, all that might really happen with that data is that it'll end up walking off sometime, like 23 million Veterans Administration records did. That's exactly the nightmare of gun owners. And
well,
that was the problem.
Where would it walk off to, though? I don't understand what...
In this case, a disc with that many records, or a computer medium of some kind, was stolen. But in Canada, the computer registry was hacked, and it helped get guns into the wrong hands, because criminals knew exactly which homes had collections of guns, and those were the ones that they began targeting. And it was an amazing upsurge of burglaries in homes that had more than one firearm. So there are a lot of reasons why the government should not be keeping this kind of information. The government doesn't seem to really care much about the privacy of the people that it would be keeping all these tabs on. And I think the Veterans Administration episode is only the most recent, but it should really be a wake-up call.
But Larry Perrin, let me just come back at you with a statistic that I've come across, and this has been widely reported. 60% of gun crimes come from just 1% of gun dealers. So nobody is saying that most gun deals are crooked. They're not. Most of them are legitimate, and they're law-abiding dealers. But doesn't that stand to reason that if you can trace these guns, you could more easily target the crooked gun dealers who are contributing to this problem?
Well, 1% of the gun dealers do also the greatest volume. There are a few exceptions in that data, but basically you're talking about the largest number of gun sales. So it's not too surprising that, just like the largest automobile dealer probably has the largest incidence of people in being involved in accidents with his automobile, not because he carelessly sells them, but because he's got a large volume.
Hmm. Anthony,
yeah, go ahead, Joe Vince.
Looking at those statistics, what you really start to see when you do a comparison is that 86% of all licensed dealers have never had one crime gun traced back to them. Well, like we said, this list, less than 1%, has almost 60% of all the guns traced back to them. And when you compare that to dealers even within their zip code, let alone in their state, what we start to see is that these smaller gun dealers are attributing more crime guns than all the Walmarts, all the Kmarts, and all a major sporting goods store in the state combined. Even if it's inadvertent, why wouldn't we stop this? Isn't this an intervention technique that we should be using? We wouldn't allow a pharmacist to go out and inadvertently give Oxycontin out to anybody, or other pharmaceuticals that could be used to make methamphetamine, but yet we want to do this for guns. It doesn't make any sense.
Hold on, Larry Pratt. I got to ask. Larry, wait a minute. I'm going to let you come back in a moment, but there is another voice I want to get into this discussion, and he's been waiting patiently on the line. It's Gil Kurlikowski. Sorry to stumble on your name. Gil Kurlikowski is the police chief from the Seattle Police Department. And Chief Kurlikowski, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's important for us to hear a voice from the sort of front lines of this problem that we're talking about. You've been listening patiently. Chime in any way you want. I'd like to know what you make of this debate and what you would like to see happen. You know, why don't you start off by giving us a sense of what the challenge Seattle is facing right now?
Well, last year our gun crime shootings went up about 25%, and this year we're outpacing last year. Now, Seattle is has an unbelievably low violent crime rate. But, you know, that was an interesting point earlier when Larry brought up the comparisons with Fairfax County, et cetera. And you can spin these numbers any way you want, but essentially here's what the FBI says every year on the front page when they release crime statistics. It says don't compare one geographical location to another. There's lots of reasons: demographics, transience, population density, economy, and on and on. So to link these things to a particular gun law, either lack of or stronger gun laws, and say that this is the reason that crime is up or down, or violent crime with guns is up or down, I think is just a huge mistake, and it doesn't add to the debate. Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about here is pretty reasonable, common sense kind of stuff. Put the assault weapons ban back in, allow law enforcement to have access to trace data on guns that were seized by law enforcement. So we're not talking at all about recording or information about legitimate lawful gun owners, which I think most people, the vast majority of people in this country, support.
Mm. Anthony, let me go back to this point that we didn't get to yet about
But Larry Pratt, with respect to the police chief, I would really like you to respond to the concern that he made, because, I mean, you know,
to get to that too.
Let's start with him, just because he's kind enough to be on the line. He makes a very compelling case from the front lines there, and I just want you to respond directly
to his concern. Were to reinstitute, say, a ban on semi-automatic firearms that he's called assault weapons, it would make absolutely no difference. We saw absolutely no difference when the ban went on in the 90s. When it came off, we saw no difference. We would see no difference because these guns have never been used in a significant amount of crime. In New York State, in the run-up to the national ban in the early 90s, the state police did a study, and they found that you were something like 5 times more likely to be killed by somebody using their hands and their feet than with one of those semi-automatic firearms. The fact is we seem to enjoy focusing on things that are not the problem. Getting these dealers to somehow magically disappear that are allegedly the source of the problem, we ought to take a look at what happened in England, where we basically have no dealers left because we have hardly any private gun ownership left, and yet they have, the police estimate, some maybe twice as many illegal firearms in the country now as what they confiscated from all the legal gun owners back in 1997. Criminals get guns. They're not going to be deterred by what you do to some dealers. All that's going to happen is, as it did in England, is that the good guy isn't able to protect himself now, but the criminal has hardly been deterred.
Mm. Let's take a call. Anthony is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for joining us.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a couple of points. I'll try to be as quick as possible.
Please.
First of all, the individual who brought up the Fairfax comparison, this is absolutely ridiculous. I live in Washington, D.C. Fairfax County is one of the most affluent counties in the United States of America. They wouldn't have gun crime, period. I mean, it's just not relevant. Secondly, gun ownership is a privilege, and it should be treated as such, meaning there should be a certain level of increased responsibility levied on those people who choose to own guns. And that means, if that means extra registration, that means a possible hassle or something along those lines, then that's what it means. I mean, these people don't need to, you know, own guns for various reasons, but they decide to do so. And just like people decide to make other choices and they're levied extra responsibility, gun owners should have extra responsibilities as well.
So, Anthony, are you talking about extra responsibilities like more registration? Some people have talked about if we have to register all cars, why not register all guns?
Exactly and precisely. Now, fine, it might take you extra time, it might cost you a little bit of extra money, but this is a decision that individuals are making. They are deciding to own these guns, and because of that, they basically deserve the extra responsibility. If I can make one last point, I think the biggest, most crucial issue is this. Those persons who own guns are largely suburban, they're largely rural, they're largely, well, in many cases, wealthy. Those people who are being killed by gun crime are largely urban, they're largely poor, and I think that, you know, this is one of the reasons why we're not getting the kind of initiative behind this problem that we should.
Okay, well, Anthony, you put a lot on the table. Go ahead, Larry Pratt.
If we want to just limit ourselves to looking at, say, one state, the data from that one jurisdiction would be Florida, which has had the longest experience with a recent, relatively recent, it's been about 20 plus years now, that they went to a concealed carry system, which greatly eased the restrictions. Basically, if you're not a crook, they got to give you a permit. And their murder rate in Florida has steadily declined over the years. It was above the national average before the law went on the books, and now it has declined some 40% over the years, a steady decline within that one state because of the ability of more and more people to take advantage of that law.
Okay, let me just throw that out to Chief Kurlikowski in Seattle. Is that a good idea, conceal and carry permits? Is that the way to bring the level of homicides and shootings down in your city?
Well, no. I mean, because we went back, and I'll say it again, when you make these kinds of comparisons and try and link it to a particular gun law, it is just an absolutely false claim. Now, let me tell you something else Florida has in place, though, and that is the requirement that people absolutely secure their firearm, and failure to secure the firearm can result in criminal charges. And I'd like to know if Larry supports the states then that require the firearm be secured, and that people that fail to secure that firearm are charged criminally.
What do you think, Larry?
No, it's a bad idea. First of all, that law has not been on the books nearly as long as the concealed carry law.
But Florida's had it a long, long time, almost as long.
No, sure not almost as long at all. It's only been about 10 or 15 years, and the carry law has been on the books about 25 years. The fact is that when you have a requirement to have every gun in the house secured in some fashion, you're telling the homeowner, and more importantly, you're telling the home invader that the home invader is going to have an advantage, because if he's invading a law-abiding home at that point, he's got a substantial advantage. People, when they're under stress, are not as competent physically, and to have to operate a lock or a combination greatly enhances the criminal's advantage in such a situation. So it's a very bad idea, and it's based on the assumption that we don't really need our guns for self-defense, and therefore they all ought to be locked up. And that's a false assumption. And it's not, by the way, a false assumption to say that that when these concealed carry laws have gone on the books, that the crime has gone down, and that somehow other factors would explain it. That's not true, because Florida has plenty of poverty. Florida has plenty of all kinds of conditions, but the fact of the matter is, where you make it easier, look at Arlington, Virginia. If you want to, there's a city that's almost identical in its characteristics to Washington, D.C., and yet it's got about a tenth of the murder rate of Washington, D.C.
Okay,
big difference, though.
Larry, we've got a couple more callers that I'd like to try to fit in before the end of the hour. John is calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, John.
Hi.
Welcome to the U.S. What's on your mind?
Oh, thanks. If Virginia has guns readily available, then there is no effective gun control in Washington, D.C., so you can't make that argument.
You can. Because we don't have the problem in Virginia.
You can drive out, get a gun, go back to Washington. It's not a very far drive. You do that. If you wanted to compare jurisdictions, say, well, one area is with gun control is a failure or is good, and one area with no gun control is fairly or a good. Compare the United States as a whole, which has rural and urban areas and the whole gambit, and compare it to another country. Now, Canada, I'm not bragging or anything, it's just Canada has one-third the murder rate of the United States. And I can't imagine anything that's very much different between our two countries that way. Culturally, we're, you know, pretty much the same, and people are people. I mean, there's good people and bad people in both countries. And also the example that's been given about Great Britain with their murder rate going up. Great Britain has a lower murder rate than Canada, so it's hard to view that as a failure. And just one last point. I was just wondering what you think about the 1939 Miller Supreme Court case, which defines what an organized militia is.
I think you're getting a little far afield. I want to pick up the point you make about the idea of less guns in Canada and a lot less murder. Joe Vince, I mean, chime in here, because there's sort of two points that have been put on the table, and I want to sort of get you back in the conversation. It seems at the heart of Larry Pratt's argument that we're hearing is that gun control doesn't work. And, you know, do we have empirical evidence that gun control does work?
Well, I think we put so many restrictions on its usage. We have over the years. We have a federal agency, ATF, who does the agents do a fantastic job with limited resources. I mean, we have 2,000 agents for over 50 states. That's not even a medium-sized police department. We never got real on that. We have 800 inspectors for 100,000 federally licensed dealers to inspect. Again, we keep putting restrictions on this by the gun lobby so that it can't be enforced, so it won't work. And in essence, what we're doing is we're not helping public safety.
Well, when Joseph says that...
This has got to be the last point, Larry Pratt, because we're just about out of time.
He didn't really answer your question, does gun control, is there evidence that it works? The Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, a federal agency, studied all of the studies that have been done on gun control and found that the answer is no. It has had no impact. Now, I would argue
disagree
that they were
with
a little
you,
weak on that. Well, you can't disagree on what the CDC found.
Well, wait a minute. I'm going to settle this because, I mean, I can't settle it. This debate is obviously going to continue, but Larry Pratt, in fairness, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also reports that there are 30,000 gun deaths a year in the U.S., and that suggests perhaps that something more needs to be done.
Their study was that the gun control laws have had no effect. So whatever people are doing with guns doesn't seem, in their opinion, to relate to gun control laws. And in fact, I'd much rather raise my family in Fairfax County, Virginia, than in the crime capital of our country.
You're misreading that report, Larry.
We've got to leave it there. I'm sorry to cut you gentlemen off. It's been a great debate, a great discussion. Thank you all for joining us. Chief Gil Kerlikowski, Police Chief of Seattle, thank you so much for hanging in there and being with us.
You're welcome.
And Joe Vince, a retired special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Anthony.
Appreciate it. And Larry Pratt, Executive Director of Gun Owners of America and host of the radio show Live Fire, thank you as well for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.